That guy gets his or her comeuppance in the end. And I think his tenure was very representative of a big sea change in the way we do white-collar crime in this country.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us, Matt Taibbi. Again, we will link to your piece at Rolling Stone. It's called The $9 Billion Witness. Meet the woman, J.P. Morgan Chase, paid one of the largest fines in American history to keep from talking. And thank you to that woman, Elaine Fleishman. Thank you so much for joining us. Elaine Fleishman, the J.P. Morgan Chase whistleblower, former deal manager at J.P. Morgan, where she says she witnessed massive criminal securities fraud in the bank's mortgage operations during the period leading up to the financial crisis. And congratulations on your book coming out in paperback, Matt. Thanks so much, everyone, for being with us. Happy birthday to Karen Meadows. I'll be speaking in Princeton on Sunday. Check our website, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltzer, Mate Nirmin Sheikh. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Plugged In on KBOO is a radio show dedicated to underground electronic music. The show is hosted by DJ Tronic and features deep house, tech house, techno, drum and bass, breakbeats, future bass, downtempo, and more. Plugged In frequently has local producers and DJs on the show, and we provide info about upcoming events in Portland, including free ticket giveaways. Plugged In airs the first and third Friday of every month from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Pacific time.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor My Name is Rachel Corey, a play based on the diaries and letters of an activist killed in 2003 when she was acting as a human shield between an Israeli bulldozer and a Palestinian home. My Name is Rachel Corey shows on Sunday, November 9th at 7 p.m. at the Elliott Chapel of the First Unitarian Church, 1034 Southwest 13th Avenue in Portland. There will be a discussion following the play with Cindy and Craig Corey, the actress and the producer. Again, that's My Name is Rachel Corey, Sunday, November 9th, 7 p.m. at the Elliott Chapel of the First Unitarian Church in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is now 5:02 p.m. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News, made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Aladdin Theater, presenting an evening with the trumpet and vocals of Herb Alpert and Lanny Hall, Tuesday, November 11th. Tickets and information for Herb Alpert and Lanny Hall available at aladdin-theater.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, President Obama deploys an additional 1,500 troops in Iraq.
The Affordable Care Act heads back to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales announces his team to monitor police reforms.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 7th, 2014. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Liam Delta. This morning, Portland's Mayor Charlie Hales announced that the city had selected a Chicago-based company to act as the community liaison for the implementation of police reforms. In 2012, the Department of Justice found that Portland City Police showed a practice of using excessive unconstitutional force against citizens, particularly in mental health crises. Portland negotiated a package of reforms with changes to police training, oversight, and policies on use of force. Today, the mayor announced his choice for a team to monitor the police bureau and make sure it follows those reforms. The city had already been criticized by people involved in the selection process, including Becky Child, a mental health advocate and an advisor to the Mental Health Association of Portland. Child was invited to participate in the selection of candidates for the contract of the community liaison. After attending meetings and interviewing candidates, Child pointed out that the city's hiring announcement produced a handful of candidates with underwhelming credentials. She said that other organizations with non-political checks and balances in place would recognize this error and repair it by seeking more candidates. But despite warnings and a delay of several months, city administrators chose to proceed with the same slate of candidates. KBOO's Ryan Katz spoke with Dennis Thierault, news editor at the Portland Mercury, about today's announcement that the city will hire a Chicago-based firm to act as the community liaison.
This week, Mayor Hales announced a team to monitor these new police reforms. Who did he choose to fill that position?
It's a team of folks largely based out of Chicago, the University of Illinois Chicago, Dennis Rosenbaum and Amy Watson. They're two professors. They were one of three finalists for that job. It's a big job. A lot of report writing, a lot of monitoring, a lot of analyzing, a lot of data collection. They really liked this team's ability to do that. They work nationally on police accountability issues. Professor Watson has done a lot of work on crisis intervention training with police departments before. But they didn't have an Oregon face, and this was supposed to have been decided this week. They're going to approve on Wednesday now, coming up, exclusive negotiating rights with one of the three finalists, this team. This was supposed to happen a week ago, but one of the reservations with this team is that they didn't have what seemed like a credible on-the-ground presence in Oregon. The other two candidates who were under consideration, you know, were going to be here, and that really matters. People need to know Portland. They need to know these issues. So they had mentioned in their application that they were going to work with a retired Oregon Supreme Court Justice, Paul DeMunis. They clarified, maybe amplified, his role in the last couple of weeks in basically getting to the point where he's going to be the on-the-ground presence here, and he's a respected person. Some of the critics of this process in the mental health community named him as an example of the kind of person they would hope had applied in the first place. You know, he presided over our state Supreme Court. I mean, this is not someone who is green and doesn't understand these issues. He actually helped mediate some of the disagreements between the police union and community groups and the city, and he was the choice of the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform. That's a big endorsement for him being part of this. I think it's a good move, actually. He's not doing the whole job. It's a big job, but he is going to be the person convening community board meetings, doing outreach, working with city officials, and sort of bringing his heft and his experience as a jurist to bear on this process.
Is the role of this team to monitor the police bureau? Is it to interact with community groups? What's sort of their role in this process?
In some ways, it's both of those things. They're not going to be doing being in charge of discipline. They're going to sort of look at when discipline happens. Is it happening in the way that the settlement agreement says it should? Are investigations happening in a timely fashion? Are the police doing the things in the settlement agreement they said? Are they properly applying the new force policies that emphasize de-escalation, that urge against overuse of tasers? Are they doing those things? Are force numbers going down? Are complaints going down? That team will be then reporting all this publicly. That's the other piece of this. This doesn't go on behind closed doors. There are regular quarterly and annual reports that are going to be filed, a lot of studies, a lot of force analyses that are going to be done, and that's a big part of the job, is really just collecting data, looking at the cops' data, and making sure it's all above board.
So what are the next steps in this process?
Next, we have to get a community oversight advisory board. This is 15 people who are going to vote and sort of transmit community feedback to the monitoring team, and that monitoring team will then translate that into reports for city council, plus all the other analysis they're doing. That's a big thing. We don't know exactly how that's going to work yet. The Human Rights Commission, the Commission on Disabilities, they're picking some people who will have mental health experience. There's going to be a process for picking 5 more at-large members to be determined. And then the city commissioners are going to pick 5 more people. And then there are going to be 5 police officers serving as advisory members of this board. And that's the next big step. And that's got to be done right. That's sort of working in tandem with this compliance officer team that the city's about to hire.
I have been speaking with Dennis Thorault from the Portland Mercury. This is Ryan Katz with KBU News.
Local labor activist Francisco Aguirre won a victory at the Hatfield Federal Courthouse today. The government has agreed to drop the warrant against Aguirre. He will be freed from jail and be able to reunite with his family. Aguirre will also be able to continue to seek permanent visa status and continue the visa application process. Francisco Aguirre is a well-known workers' rights activist. He was involved with the Workers' Organizing Committee, which was the forerunner for the VOES Workers' Rights Education Project. Aguirre was arrested on Thursday after leaving the Augustana Lutheran Church to face a drunk driving charge in Clackamas County Circuit Court. The church had previously been his refuge for the past 2 months. KBU's Dan Richardson spoke with participants at a rally in support of Aguirre this afternoon in downtown Portland.
People are very concerned and suspicious that two different channels, the Immigration Administrative Channel and the Criminal Justice Channel, are now kind of putting pressure on Francisco, and we want to make sure that they're two independent processes, that the criminal proceedings, which we don't think there's even a level of criminal activity here, so those charges should just be dismissed, and that does not get contaminated or crossed up with any administrative complications or improprieties about what his visa status is, and that also the immigration people should, separate from this criminal thing, look at his level of involvement with the community, his good conduct, and make sure that he gets the proper visa to stay here with his family and on the path to citizenship, if that's where he wants to go.
It's good to be in this country today because our federal court worked. And we are very pleased as a coalition and for Francisco Aguirre that our federal judge and the defense and the prosecution agreed that he should be released and continue his legal process to get his U visa. So we are thrilled by that, and we are thankful for that on this sunny day in Oregon. We are also very, very pleased that the ICE retaining order has been dropped. And that was said in court on record by the U.S. Attorney's representative. And so in good faith, knowing that our federal government works as one, that order has been dropped, and we publicly celebrate that. And we pray this is the beginning of a new day in this country, so many will be safe and be able to be united with their families. We are so happy for Dora, for her children, and for Francisco, and their life may continue now. So thank you today that our system can work, and we all value that. I don't know of an Oregonian who does not value a system of justice that works for justice, that truly is justice. Thank you.
I have a brief statement on behalf of Dora, Francisco's wife. She would like to say thank you to the justice system, and thank you that justice was served today and that her husband has been released. She is grateful that her husband will be able to be reunited with her and her two daughters and his son tonight, that he had been ripped apart, not only from her, but from her daughters. And so she is grateful to the justice system that tonight they will be reunited. She is also grateful and thankful that ICE has dropped a detention order on his detention. And she hopes that her and her family will be able to continue this process in peace. Thank you.
Yes.
All right, we're going to end with a chant. I'm going to say, tell me what you want, what you really want, and you're going to say justice. All right? Tell me what you want, what you really want.
Justice.
Tell me what you want, what you really want.
Justice.
Tell me what you want, what you really want.
Justice.
Tell me what you want, what you really want.
Justice.
And we have justice for Francisco Aguirre and his family. We have justice today, hopefully beginning for the 11 million undocumented people in the United States today, the hundreds of thousands of families here in Oregon today. Thank you very much.
I was wondering if there was any more input I could get about what's happened today. It's been dropped, apparently.
He still has to go to court on the leaving the country or coming back in the country illegally 15 years ago, which they're saying.
Right.
But we know he came for asylum.
Right.
But the ICE order for detainment has been dropped. And that was said by the U.S. Attorney's Office in court. So it's on the record that it's been dropped. And so we trust that our government can work properly, and we know and we honor ICE in dropping it. We thank them for dropping it, and we hope that's the new trend in this country. So we are thrilled he's released and can now continue on his legal process for his U visa and for his permanent status here in the. And Sunday night at 6 p.m., we want the whole community to turn out. We'll have speakers in the streets, a couple thousand people, music, celebration, and being re-energized for the long haul, this marathon we're in together for his family, Francisco and his family, but for every person in this nation, close to 12 million who do not have documentation or in fear every day. And we want that to end.
Thank you. This is Rosa, who is speaking on behalf of the family.
I think on a personal level, I feel really happy for the first time in days. I feel hopeful. I feel like we see a light at the end of the tunnel. I personally am excited to see him tonight. It was really devastating to see him handcuffed and taken yesterday in the courtroom. It was one of the most devastating moments of this campaign. To see him walk into the courtroom shackled like a criminal was really heartbreaking to see. That he was shackled. So I look forward to seeing him released tonight and be a free man and be able to be reunited with his family and to be back to the community where he belongs. So thank you.
Thank you.
That was Dan Richardson reporting for KBOO Radio at today's rally in support of Francisco Aguirre.
Today, President Obama announced that he would take executive action on immigration reform if Congress fails to act. He's made such promises repeatedly before. Meanwhile, the immigration system in the Pacific Northwest remains broken. When an undocumented immigrant is arrested, they're often sent to detention centers while they go through their deportation proceedings. The closest one is the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, Washington. Over the past year, detainees have complained of bad living conditions. This week, over 200 of them went on a third hunger strike in protest. KBOO reporter Ryan Katz spoke with Maru Mora Villalpando from Latino Advocacy and the Northwest Detention Center Resistance.
So I'm wondering first if you could, you know, give us a little bit of background on what's been going on recently at the Northwest Detention Center.
On October 31st, Colectivo de Detenidos called again for another hunger strike to last at least 72 hours, which they know is the time that Immigration Customs Enforcement recognizes as a hunger strike. They decided to do it on October 31st because it matched with an encampment that we did outside the detention center. The Northwest Detention Resistance Group and all of our allies camped out at the detention center from Friday, October 31st, till Monday, November 3rd. And call again, you know, the general public to call for accountability to ICE and GEO since the conditions haven't really gotten any better. Just a few things obviously have changed due to the organizing and their efforts inside and the support they're getting from groups outside. But they also wanted to call out the fact that this being the third hunger strike on the second one back in summer, the ICE regional director and the director of the Northwest Detention Center had met with a few of them, promising that they will address the issues of their demands, and that never happened. So they were pretty much saying, you know, not only things have not gotten better, but obviously now they made promises to us back in summer, and nothing has been done since.
Can you describe some of the conditions inside of the Northwest Detention Center? Why are they protesting?
They've been protesting the really low quality of food they receive. People are always hungry. They lose weight. The food is just really, really low quality in some instances. Food has been spoiled or included maggots. Obviously, that pushes them to go and buy from the commissary. The items that they can buy at the commissary are really expensive if we compare them to prices in the outside. They are also working for the detention center under this quote-unquote voluntary work program where they receive only $1 a day. They pretty much run the detention center. They run the kitchen, janitorial services, and the laundry. Also, medical treatment is not really available. People complain a lot about the fact of being sick and being put on waiting list by the time they see a doctor or nurse. they're told that they will get better, or they only given a, you know, some pills, some Tylenol. Another thing that they've been complaining about is the treatment that they receive from the guards. There's a lot of racism and discrimination going on, a sexual harassment that's been grievances filed against some of the guards that have been sexually harassing some of the detainees. We're talking about male detainees. And also they're complaining about the fact that there's no due process. It takes a really long time for them to see a judge, if they ever get to see one. And if they're eligible for bonds, the bonds are really expensive. Usually the minimum will be $15,000. We have seen other instances, but when bonds are lower than that, it's usually because detainees count on legal representation. They're able to afford it. About 80% of the detainees in the detention center will never get legal orientation or representation.
You mentioned that some officials met with some of the detainees inside. It sounds like that's a good step in the right direction, but they were promised some things. What were they promised, and then how have they failed to follow through with those promises?
They were told that list of demands that I just mentioned would be addressed. They asked how, and the officials told them, well, just fill out the grievances forms that are available. They have filled out those forms, and we then have received some of those forms after the officers replied to them, saying nothing is going to be done, or we will look into this, and nothing gets done. Some instances they say, well, we can't really tell whether you're telling the truth. We don't know whether this really happened. And so although they've been filing those grievances, there's been no positive action being taken into for each of those grievances.
How can the process be better or more transparent, and how can people get involved in this effort?
Well, really, the only way to make it more transparent is to have the legislation that Adam Smith, our congressman in the district of Washington State in that area, he introduced this bill that precisely addresses all of those problems. And it sets up a system where GEO and ICE are accountable, because right now they're not. They can do pretty much whatever they want, and they're not accountable to anybody, not to Congress, not to the general public, not to the taxpayers.
What does the bill say?
The bill is precisely, it talks about all the different conditions that should be the way they should be in the detention center, and it calls for reviews of the detention center without being announced that they're going to be giving to review conditions. And if they don't meet those requirements to have the conditions as the bill proposes that are based on the detainees' demands, then these private detention centers wouldn't be able to renew their contracts. So it's a pretty good bill, because it pretty much says if you're going to run a detention center, profit should not be your motivation.
I have been speaking with Maru Mora Villalpando from Latino Advocacy. This is Ryan Katz with KBOO News.
A missing Portland State University student named Kevin Ping was found dead last night in McMinnville. Beaverton police reported that the death was a suicide. The news comes after Ping's family made a statement yesterday that they were organizing a search for the 21-year-old. Friends and family were planning to meet on Saturday in Wilsonville to search in the area where his last cell phone signal was traced. Ping left his Beaverton home the morning of Tuesday, October 28th. That afternoon, he sent his mother a text message saying he loved her. On Wednesday, October 29th, Ping's mother told a friend she hadn't heard from him in the previous 24 hours. His friend then alerted police that the young man could be suicidal. Police report that friends and family have known Ping to make suicidal statements in the past.
A 50-year-old Portland man accused of helping to fund terrorism had a court appearance today. The lawyers for Riaz Khan called for the dismissal of charges against their client and to strike the word terrorist from the body of the indictment against Khan. Riaz Khan was arrested 2 years ago and charged with providing material support for terrorism. Specifically, he was charged with exchanging email and sending money to a man in Pakistan who later carried out a suicide bombing in 2009. In an unusual move for a terrorism case, a federal judge allowed Khan to post bail, and he remains out of custody. He works as a wastewater treatment operator in Portland, but is currently on leave from his job. Khan's lawyers want the government to name all known but unidentified co-conspirators in their client's alleged plot. And they want to know what evidence prosecutors intend to use to show Khan knew that his acquaintance planned to carry out an attack. No such evidence has been presented, despite a discovery of more than 500 emails from Khan's account.
From drenching rains and rapid snowmelt to coastal storm surges, Oregon has seen its share of extreme weather in recent years. A new report from the National Wildlife Federation finds that strengthening natural defenses could protect communities from damage while also saving money. KBOO's Andrew Knight has more in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
Protection that's natural is least expensive and maybe best when it comes to threats to life and property in Oregon because of floods and coastal storms. A new report from the National Wildlife Federation says investments in natural infrastructure need to be boosted as severe weather continues to happen more often, with some events connected to climate change. Report author Patty Glick says they found that natural flood control, such as wetlands, tend to be overlooked.
We also tend to undervalue the benefits that natural infrastructure, such as the vegetation along our rivers and streams, can provide for us.
The report recommends strengthening the Clean Water Act, as well as making improvements to the federal flood insurance program that better reflect true risks of building in flood zones. Wesley DuPont with the insurance company Allied World says it makes good business sense to take proactive steps to protect communities, especially given the impact of climate change.
They need to begin to think about cost-effective, nature-based approaches to risk mitigation. It just makes good business sense.
The report estimates that for every $1 spent on natural infrastructure, restoration, and improvements, $4 can be saved in weather damage expenses. For KBOO News, I'm Andrew Knight.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Tomorrow's weather, partly cloudy with a high of 63. Sunday we'll see a high of 57 with a chance of rain. On this day in history, the Tacoma Narrows Bridge collapsed during a heavy storm, only 4 months after its completion in 1940. On November 7, 1956, the United Nations General Assembly passed a resolution calling for the withdrawal of British, French, and Israeli forces occupying Egypt. Finally, exactly 14 years ago today, Governor George W. Bush defeated Vice President Al Gore to become president, a win falsely awarded by the U.S. Supreme Court. The quote of the day comes from Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update, which had this to say after the 2000 presidential election. In light of these events, America is canceled. Citizens are asked to choose between Canada and Mexico by 4 p.m. tomorrow.
Well, looky here. It's 5:28 and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
When it comes to policing an area, the good people of Orange County, Florida are lucky because they've got the astonishing law enforcement team of DBPR and OCSO on the beat, eager to stop any possible criminal activity. Consider just one example of the truly incredible vigilance of this dynamic policing duo. The DBPR-OCSO target in this case was a suspicious enterprise calling itself Strictly Skills, and the agents spent a month carefully planning a joint sweep operation, including a fully armed SWAT team. On the day of the raid, the team first sealed off the parking lot. Next, two undercover cops entered to size up the danger. And then, bam, the SWAT team hit the unsuspecting suspects. Wearing riot gear and brandishing guns, the team seized half a dozen of the enterprise's kingpins and cuffed them while officers searched the premises for more than an hour. You might assume that this was a narcotics operation, but no. In fact, Strictly Skills is a barbershop, What possible criminal activity led to such a militaristic show of brute force? Barbering without a license. That's only a second-degree misdemeanor. But even it was not violated in this case, for all licenses at the shop were valid. DBPR, the Department of Business and Professional Regulation, could have determined that by a routine inspection. But instead, OCSO, Orange County Sheriff's Office, got involved and decided to muscle the barbers. Why? Because it has a SWAT team and a military mentality, so it thinks it's above the law. This is Jim Hightower saying a federal court yanked this abusive duo's constitutional chain and ridiculed its routine of swatting at barbers. But it's not funny, for police run thousands of these raids a year and are rarely held accountable.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
A transgender woman was brutally attacked in an alleged hate crime on Monday in Toledo, Ohio. Candace Rose Milligan was released yesterday from Mercy St. Vincent Medical Center. She was unable to give interviews due to heavy medication. The 33-year-old underwent two surgeries, including one to drain blood from her brain after doctors found she had a hematoma. A group of three men followed Milligan in broad daylight while she was walking down a main street in downtown Toledo. They reportedly shouted, "That's a dude in a dress," among other derogatory remarks, before punching and kicking Milligan until she fell to the ground and then robbing her. Witnesses on the scene were able to provide suspect descriptions, and Toledo police charged 20-year-old Christopher Temple with robbery. A grand jury has yet to decide if the attack was motivated by hate or discrimination, which will carry additional charges. Ohio currently has no laws aimed at protecting LGBTQ rights.
A dozen students in Colorado crashed their local school board meeting last night to protest what they're calling the censorship of history. The conservative school board in Jefferson County, Colorado, had been considered